So welcome everybody to lesson four, our culminating lesson in this round of Hartman teaching, in this round of Hartman learning. So we're going to look tonight at the culminating lesson for Hartman about this section of creation ethics, covenant ethics, the tension between the two, and the next last class in that capsule is this fourth class, which is environmental ethics. So if you have environmental ethics, meaning how we approach the planet, how we approach our relationship to other living creatures, then we have to bring both creation and covenantal understandings of what ethics are founded on and what our approach is, and then the tension between the two. We also have to bring that to bear on our conversation about the environment. I feel like we assume a lot about our community as a liberal Jewish community committed to science and reality and an appreciation of the natural world. I feel like we take it for granted that we understand that Jews have a commitment to protecting the environment. And what I find is we very rarely actually talk about the grounding in our tradition for that. So at first I'm like, ah, we don't need this. Who needs this class? We know this stuff. And then I'm like, oh, actually, these texts, really? Most of them are unfamiliar to me in the liberal Jewish conversation about ethics involving the planet and other life on the planet. So, I want to say from the get-go that, as we're talking about the environment, I go back to Hartman last summer where we had someone tell us that essentially what we're doing right now, if we're responsible and aware and really connected to what's happening, what we're doing, if we're at our best as Jews and as human beings, we are doing hospice for human life on this planet. And I'm like, what? Like, that was so sobering for all of us. None of us gave that lecture a thumbs up. And all of my colleagues, myself included, have really had to take in seriously what it means to say, maybe what we need to do is hospice.
What?
Hospice. The human life on this planet is dying. And so, and it's gonna die. Like it's not sustainable. So, in the conversation, one of the things we kept saying was the planet and the like life on the planet's gonna die, like planet equals human life. And what was really instructive for me is one of my brilliant colleagues said, life on the planet will be fine. Certain life on the planet will be fine. We keep talking about destroying the planet. We're not gonna destroy the planet. The planet will still be floating in space. Like, circling around the sun until it's not, but that's a really long time from now. We're not going to degrade the planet circling the sun. Other things will, but it's not the planet that's in trouble. And we keep talking that way, don't we? We say, oh, we're going to kill the planet. The planet needs us to blah, blah, blah. The planet's going to be fine. Remember Planet of the Apes? The planet survives. I watched, The Walking Dead. It was filmed in Noonan, Georgia. Right? Judy's hometown. It was filmed like 45 minutes south of where I live. So when you watch dystopian futures like that, what you see is the planet's fine. Right? The planet just takes over the freeways and takes over the skyscrapers. And like the planet's fine, but what's gone is sentient human life. Which in depending on which episode of which thing you watch is a good thing or a bad thing. That human sentient life is gone may not be such a bad thing. And in other cases, we think, well, that would be the biggest tragedy that could happen on this planet. So I just want to put all of this in context. We are not talking about the death of the planet. We're talking about what our relationship to the environment means for us. And as living sentient beings, what it means for us to make decisions for other living creatures on this planet who can't survive some of our decisions. Right. So with that happy, happy introduction, I want to look first at the framing I'm supposed to give y'all a little bit about this idea of creation ethics. So y'all who have studied with me know Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are very different in their approach to humanity and the planet and God and where we belong in that whole system, but not everyone has learned with us this Torah section. So I just want to briefly give you a few verses of Genesis 1. Genesis 1, male and female, God created them. God said, "See, I give you every seed-bearing plant that is upon the earth and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit. They shall be yours for food, and to all the animals on land, to all the birds of the sky, and to everything that creeps on earth in which there is breath of life, I give all the green plants for food." And it was so. And God saw all that God had made and found that it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. So just before that, in verse 28, God says, "Be fertile, increase, fill the earth, and..." Kurt Kleiman, you want to do it? Or should I do it?
Start.
Ah! Yeah, no, I can count it.
"Fill
the earth and master it. And rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on earth."
What is the Hebrew? Is master a good translation of the Hebrew? Or what does the Hebrew say?
I didn't pay him for that. But he has a good point to say we translate Kivshuha as master. It does seem to be something about a dominant role, right? Over the thing that we call now this vegetated earth, right? And there seems to be some sense that there is a understood control that human beings will have regarding the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and the living things that creep on the earth. That's Genesis 1. If we go to Genesis 2, Adonai Elohim takes the person and the earthling and places the earthling in the Garden of Eden to till and to tend it. Okay? So these are two very different creation stories. If you haven't learned with me, you don't know how different they are, but they are very, very different in many ways. We're just going to look at the relationship of the human to other living things part of it. One is kind of you get to have a certain amount of control over it. But in Genesis 2, right? You are to till and to tend it. Shomra. La'avda, to work it, and l'shomra, to guard it, essentially. So Shomre Adama is an environmental Jewish group. Shomre Adama, tenders, guardians of the earth. Okay. So we've already in Genesis two very different understandings of the human relationship to the environment and to the other living creatures in that environment. So we're just going to honor that those are both there. We're going to look first at our first source, which comes from Ecclesiastes Rabbah. So this is about the balance between human mastery, which we see in the first Genesis text, and discipline, which comes with the idea of Shomra, that you are to take care of her. You are to tend her. Shomra, feminine, tend her, meaning the planet, creation. All right. So then what we're coming to with source one in Ecclesiastes Rabbah is this tension between use and exploitation. Use seems okay. You can use it. What do we do when we take use to the extreme? We talk about, right, exploitation. All right, so let's look at source one. And someone want to read source one, please. Right.
"Be the works of God, for who can repair that which he has perverted? When God created the first human being, God took him around to see all of the trees of the Garden of Eden and said to him, 'See my creatures, how beautiful and praiseworthy they are. And all that I have created for you. careful not to ruin or destroy my world. For if you ruin it, no one will repair it for you.
All right. So we have this idea that if humanity breaks what God has made, then who can repair it? My creations, how beautiful and praiseworthy they are. All that I've created for you so that you can be in a relationship, you can enjoy them. Don't ruin or destroy it, for who will repair it after you? What does this say to you about the ethics of us being in control of things?
There's responsibility inherent in it.
That inherent in control and the ability to affect things is responsibility. And what do you see as what this is hinting at minimally as the responsibility?
Maintain, not to completely trash it.
To maintain and not completely trash it. Okay? Yeah. Yes, Mary.
Because it implies that God is.
Say I can't, a little louder over the fan, please.
It says that he has perverted capital H, implying that God is the one who has done the damage.
Yes. Then ki mi yochel itaken et asher oto b'sha'a shebara. I don't know that that's not a typo. Yeah, but it's a good point. Thank you for noticing. But me, because in the Hebrew there is no capitals. So mi yochel itaken et asher oto. Like, who would be capable of repairing what he has made wrong? In the moment, in the time that God created the person, the human, the first human, blah, 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 blah. So we don't have a capital, but I think you're right. That actually, I should.
Yeah.
And you knew. Thank you so much. Thoughtful. Marissa, that you are, that you brought me a pen, knowing I wouldn't come with one and would need one. So it's that last vav about whether it should be a capital H or a lowercase h. I don't think it can be a capital. You're totally right.
So he just meaning man, people.
People, yeah. Humanity, right? Because God doesn't pervert God's own, right creation. But who does? Right? But let me look at the Mishnah. So now that I'm looking at my Hartman notes, what do you think of the shift from God perverting creation to humanity doing so?
Well, humanity didn't exist before then. So why was God afraid that earthlings would wreck or pervert the earth?
So say the first part of what you said again.
This was just at the beginning.
Yes.
And the first human, had not yet, stepped on earth. So why would God have had in mind the idea that this earthling that God was going to create could cause such, destruction to the planet?
So what? Where do you see that before God creates the human, God's concerned about that? It seems God instructs the humans about the right relationship between humanity and the environment. Yeah, good.
I was thinking this was Genesis. So never mind.
We love that. So, right. So to be clear, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, it's both about God saying, now that there is humanity, here's the right relationship between humanity and the environment around the humans, which in both cases is understood that the human will have control to a large extent. And then what is our responsibility vis-a-vis that control? All right. So let's go to source 2. Let's go to Midrash Tanchuma. So my Hartman notes tells me this text offers two philosophies regarding humanity's relationship to nature. One valorizes nature itself as perfect, while the other valorizes human intervention in nature. All right, so we're going to look at text 2. Who wants to read the English? Okay,
Ernest Rufus the Wicked, Rabbi Akiva, which are more beautiful, the works of God or of flesh and blood?
All right, so Ternus Rufus is a Roman officer who is in dialogue here. I'm going to keep interrupting you. That's okay, Bert, because it's long for me to talk first. The Rabbi Akiva, of course, is the hero of the Jewish story of the Talmud. He's like one of our most amazing minds and hearts and thinkers in the early Amoraim. And it turns out later, we don't know this now, but Ternus Rufus kills Akiva. He's the one who kills Akiva. You remember Akiva's one of the martyrs who was flayed alive by the Romans. So this is a precursor to Rufus actually killing Akiva. So this is not an argument between the rabbis. This is not two equal opinions according to the rabbis. This is the dominant Roman imperial understanding of things versus the Jewish, you're nothing, you don't matter, and you don't think like us, and you don't have our intellectual superiority, and y'all are nothing. It's not an argument that we usually get in our text this way. It's an argument this way.
Right. So this is, which are more beautiful, the works of God, or I assume the works of flesh and blood? Those things are made by humans.
Yes.
Okay. He responded, he being Akiva?
Yes.
Those of flesh and blood are more beautiful.
No. That's Rufus.
Well, it says the wicked asked Akiva.
Oh, yeah. You're right. It's Akiva.
Okay, because I don't understand that Akiva would say those of flesh and blood are more beautiful than those
because
of God.
It's pee-pee. It's chutzpah, right? Oh, okay. It's chutzpah.
Ernest Rufus, the wicked, responded, behold the heavens and the earth. Can you make something like them? Rabbi Akiva responded, do not speak with me about something which is beyond humans, for they do not control them, but regarding things that are found among people.
And who is the God that the Roman is referring to? Yes, the Roman pantheon, right? So remember, this is not an argument about Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as God. It's about the Roman pantheon and what the pagan gods create.
So Akiva is saying that the works of humans are more beautiful than the works of the Greek gods.
Don't discount, right, the role of humanity in what's most important and what's ultimate.
Okay, he responded. That would be Ternus Rufus.
Yes.
I assume, because he asks, why do you circumcise?
Okay, why is that legitimate here? Why that here?
Manipulating God's creation.
If God created the penis with a foreskin, why would you circumcise? If you say God's works are like so great, like what's up with circumcision?
He, Akiva, responded, I knew you would ask this.
Like, duh, because y'all don't circumcise, and oh, wait, do.
Hence. Mm-hmm. Is there a word like that in Hebrew?
Yeah.
Really, hence?
Okay.
Hence, I said in advance that the works of flesh and blood are more beautiful than those of God. He brought him ears and loaves. He said to him, now which he is this?
He said to him, who said the word?
That's what I'm trying to, unpack this. He said to him, these are the works of God. And these are the works of flesh and blood. That sounds like Akiva, who's saying that they're separate. But he doesn't say the work of gods.
Nope.
What word for God is he using here?
Let's look at the Hebrew.
Oh,
and
he is
the KBH. The Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy Blessed One.
These are the works of God, and these are the works of flesh and blood. Are these not more beautiful? They brought him bundles of flax and garments from Beth Shean. He said, these are the works of God, and these are the works of flesh and blood. Are these not more beautiful?
So we're talking about the difference between what is created and made by the divine and what human technology makes possible with that. Which is superior, right? What's created because that's created by the divine, or what's created and then what human beings do with it. Notice we don't say a bracha over the challah on Friday night. Blessed are you, God, who makes challah. Right? Because that would be silly and stupid. Blessed are you, God, who brings forth what?
The earth.
Lechem from the earth. Does lechem come from the earth? No. Lechem only happens when human beings interact with wheat. Right? So, and do we say, blessed are you, God, who brings forth wine?
The fruit of the
vine. The fruit of the vine. Because what does that take? Human technology, human wisdom, human experience, human hands, human minds have to be involved in dealing with grapes to bring wine from grapes and lechem from wheat, right? So we tend to bless the partnership. So this is where the Roman is saying, wait a minute, we're going to try to trip you up. Like in that, we're going to make it a binary. We're going to make it an either or. So go on. So if you, a child is born with a foreskin, like if it's, you know, then why would you take that off if it's perfect from your creator?
Well, Turnus Rufus said to him, if God wants circumcision, why doesn't the child leave its mother's womb already circumcised?
Right.
God could have.
Right.
Rabbi Akiva responded, why does the umbilical cord come out attached to the baby? Does not his mother cut his umbilical cord? So why does the child not leave the womb already circumcised? Because God gave Israel the commandments to purify them. Therefore, David said, every word of God is pure.
All right. So what do you make of that argument? If it's already created, perfect, and it doesn't need the human being's interaction with it, then why is the baby born with an umbilical cord that has to be cut by human beings? Right? So the argument is your ridiculousness of circumcision, you're interfering with what's already perfect. If you say it's the divine that makes things perfect, then why interfere with circumcision? And Akiva answers, because it's a partnership. It's a partnership. That what gets created by the divine is amazing. What we as human beings can do with our technologies is improve upon what the divine has created
through his command.
Well, I love oaks, and I think for me, what hits me in the heart here is that I think what he's also saying, I'm not trying to correct anything, is that God gave us the ability to improve upon the things he created. That, I mean, not the
truth, yeah,
but to add to it and to make things, you know, to be special. Am I wrong?
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. So we have the beauty of the created world, and we have our human ability to interact with it in a way that we can affect it. And in Akiva's argument, and everybody's argument, if you talk about universality of cutting the umbilical cord is a good idea, right? Which, let me tell you, as a mother who has birthed a child, it's a really good idea to cut that thing, that blood-sucking parasite loose, who I adore and love and pay for her tuition. So,
with all due respect.
With all due respect, exactly. So it's a partnership. That's what Akiva's arguing, that you can't make it a binary, that either, right, the created perfection of a godly force or something done by humanity, that one or the other is what's good. And Akiva suggests that God gives us the world, according to Hartman, and expects human beings to refine it.
Yeah.
We're given raw materials. We are expected to then take them to the next level. All right. So, but we can't do that, obviously, to places that are going to be now marring the environment, the physical world that we're given, to an extent that is unacceptable. And this is, of course, where the conversation is in humanity right now, never more vociferously, I think, than right now, in a way, thank God, that we're having the conversation, but it's also, this is where the tension is. We are given the natural world. We are supposed to improve upon it and refine it. What does that mean? Where are the limits and boundaries? How do we even start to think about categories of responsibility versus permission versus it's very complicated, which is why I think Hartman brings it forward. So, David, yes.
Sorry, is there a difference between the collaboration in Garden of Eden, collaboration post-Garden of Eden?
I'm sure they can't hear you on this. So I'm going to say your question is, isn't there a difference between the collaboration in the Garden of Eden and the collaboration after the Garden, meaning between humanity and God?
Post-humanity. So you're picking, naming the animals and working with God in the Garden of Eden. Then you get picked out and you're still working, but it's a different relationship, with nature, basically.
So in the garden, you're doing some things. Then outside the garden, now that you've been exiled from the garden, you're doing the same kinds of things, but it's a different relationship. What do you want to lift up as the core of the difference that's concerning you right now? Like what?
Well, it seems to me that post-cultivated kind of been in conflict with nature. You're fighting it because you're trying to survive. And inside the garden, you know, it's kind of nice, actually. You're not fighting it because everything's...
So post-Eden, you have to work the land in a certain way because you're not just being fed automatically. So that relationship of now to Ovda, to work it and to tend it, Shomra, is different. For sure. I think the idea of bringing these two texts forward before expulsion is, what was the original idea of a Jewish ethical understanding of how we're supposed to relate to the earth?
Well, I just say that ethical understanding can't possibly be how we related to nature in Garden of Eden. That's a bad place to start because it's the Garden of Eden. You're not in conflict.
But it's where we start. So when the rabbis look at those texts, when the Israelite authors are putting forward these texts, this is their ideal. So if you can stop for a minute about we were in the garden, now we're not. If we don't take it literally, think of it as Eden, the relationship as stated in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 about Eden is the ideal. What's the ideal? Yes, we don't live in that world. Yes, but the ideal in Genesis 1 is different from the ideal in Genesis 2. How do we carry those forth into a world where we're no longer living in the ideal, but those ideas are still supposed to inform how we behave? Yes, we are supposed to. In other words, it's not antithetical to say till the earth intended. And you can still get bread from the earth. Those are not antithetical. Pre-expulsion and post-expulsion, those are not antithetical. Same with the next text, which says, or the first one, but I'm confusing them, but conquer it and you have control over it. That's not different or antithetical from being in the garden and then being expelled. It's a theory of how we're supposed to relate.
Yeah. I think the lack of want or being desperate kind of makes you do bad things.
Okay. Well, that's different because this is written and talked about and studied by and enacted by people who are agrarian, who are doing pretty well. They're doing pretty well. These are landed, wealthy Israelites. This is not written to a slave population. This is not written to people who are on the edge of scraping by. These texts are written and studied by people who are doing pretty well in relationship to the earth. Right. And when they're not, that's a whole nother conversation, which is interesting that they reference back to this mythic time of Eden to talk about what it means for us now. So I get it. I totally get what you're saying, that the mythic Eden is a very different situation from people who are scraping by. And this is written and studied by a population that's living well in relationship to the earth. It's the mythological starting point of their values. We would put ours in a different place, right? But as America, if we think about where do we place our mythic values, oh, we, you know, wanted freedom for everybody and we rebelled against England and blah, 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 blah. Really? Really? Right?
Right. To your old player.
So what is it determined that we're doing a bad thing?
That what, that we're doing a bad thing? When have we said we're doing a bad thing?
It's to the environment or to, I mean, because people who drilled for oil at the beginning, they didn't think they were doing a bad thing by drilling oil. So when did the judgment come?
Very interesting that you should ask that, Stephen, because that's where they want us to go next. So because you raised such a great question, let's look at source 3 and have you read the English.
There was a certain calf that was being led to slaughter. The calf went and hung its head on the corner of Rabbi Yehuda
Hanasi, Judah the prince.
It was weeping. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said to it, go as you were created for this purpose. It was said in heaven, since he was not passionate toward the calf, let afflictions come upon him. The Gemara explains statement left him due to another incident. One day, the maidservant of Rabbi Yehuda was sweeping his house. There were young weasels lying about. She was in the process of sweeping them out. Rabbi Yehuda Nahasi said to her, let them be, as it is written, Lord is good to all, and his mercies are over all his works. They said in heaven, since he was compassionate, we shall be compassionate on him. He was relieved of his suffering.
So, talk to me now, Stephen Lewis. We're allowed to exploit certain parts of nature and the environment, including animals and other living things. We're allowed to eat meat according to our tradition. So you just asked, so they were drilling for oil and originally that wasn't a bad thing. You can use that for your fossil fuels, for your, you know, machines and the things that you need. In this case, you're allowed to kill a calf and eat it. Okay. So you're allowed to drill. You're allowed to kill. So talk to me about what this text says about what's the difference.
Like drilling at the same
category. Well, they do. The Hartman does. Hartman is saying this text about.
So they've already made that distinction as to what's bad.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes, no. They did because God said, you can go ahead and kill this because I said you could. But you can't kill the weasel because I didn't say you could kill
it. No. You can kill a calf because you can eat it. What is the sin of Yehuda Hanasi? What's wrong with his approach to that? He didn't have any compassion for what it might mean for the suffering of that animal. He did not respect that you're taking a life to eat meat. Like, what are you worried about? Like, that's what you were created for. Like, what's the big deal? Right. He learns with the weasel. The weasel shows he learned. Because now when it comes to the weasel, he's like, wait. The weasel just being a weasel. Like, why are you going to, like, clobber it with a broom when that's unnecessary? You could just kind of scooch it out of the house. So this text is coming to show us that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi had the wrong approach. So when you start drilling, fine, you're allowed to drill and you're allowed to use that oil. That's kosher. You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to eat meat. I would ask you from this text, what do you think the line is when you say now it's no longer okay? You can eat meat, but in this case, there's a reprimand around a callousness to what that means.
So I have to kill passion for what it is.
Or
recognize that it's wrong and stop it.
Because what?
Because it's not fruitful and it doesn't serve.
Or what's wrong with drilling for oil now, people? Huh? Speak up, Lisa.
It ruins the environment. It's not healthy for our world.
Using fossil fuels is killing the environment and everything in it. What else? Drilling for oil does what?
Ruins the land.
Ruins the land and ruins that land for other creatures. You're allowed to use them. You're allowed to slaughter. You're allowed to raise animals to slaughter. You are not allowed to be callous about what that means.
Wasteful.
Or wasteful. And we're going to see that soon.
So as long as you recognize it, can you still continue doing it?
Well, if you recognize, like, this is where, and I'm not saying I have the answer. I'm saying the rabbis bring, I mean, Hartman brings the rabbis' text forward to say they are contemplating, we're permitted, but there are limits. Where are the limits? That becomes our conversation about drilling's okay. Sure. Until, and then we have to decide. So where for us is the limit of saying fracking is freaking bad? Like, right? Like,
the water for oil.
I have a very close friend of mine for many years. He's a vegan. And we get into these argumentative, not yelling at each other, but, and one of the things I said to him recently was, you know, and I really respect everything everyone said. If we don't raise cows, then they won't exist. So, you know, how do we, but what's so interesting here is the rabbi's basically talking as a con artist to the cow. And maybe if he meant what he said to the cow was talking. I mean, if the cow was talking, then maybe you should bless him and say, you know, we raised you and we care. And it sounds a little cuckoo, but these are the basis of the humanity of the situation. If we didn't have cattle ranches, cows would never be born and wouldn't get to have a chance to live. And if we slaughter them, not slaughter them, it's a horrible word, but very carefully let them live out and be kind the way things are done, that's the best we could do if we're eating meat.
So, right. And so that is the deal that we make with living creatures, is that if we're going to eat them, you can eat them, you can raise them to slaughter them. And to your point, but the text is suggesting what you can't be is callous to the fact right. that when you eat meat, you are eating something that was alive and got killed for you to eat it. And so for us now to take that forward is if you're not going to be vegan and you're not going to be vegetarian, right? The conversation among many Jewish communities and other communities of value, who are weighing the values of what consumption means is, so what does that mean for me to be callous? Right. So what I heard you say is the criticism is he was in the face of this calf, literally, and like being callous. So what does that translate to for us? So back off of fracking, backing off of oil. What does it even mean for consumption of food? Right. So if we say, OK, I'm fine with eating meat, which I do. I eat meat. I eat chicken. I eat fish. I'm the top of the food chain. I do not apologize. I want to take seriously the idea that, well, what does that mean for me to not be callous to what I support in terms of the kinds of meat I eat and the kinds of experience of the animals that I consume, how they're treated, how the workers are treated, yep. how, what the experience of free range chickens is versus like being in pens and in their yeah. filth and pecking each other to death all the time and the stress hormones that are flowing through that.
Seems to me that macro, macro, macro. The issue is, can we just do whatever we want?
What is the answer to that, Bert?
The Jewish answer is no. And the Jewish answer is that because we believe there is divinity in this world, or they call it God, or Yudhavave, whatever you want to call it, and that we partner with that. Some rabbis said, the world was half created by God, and it is our job to partner in the finishing of the creation.
Right. So that's this talk about refinement.
Right.
God creates it, we refine it.
That as we approach resource, as we approach killing animals, it's an old argument, does God belong at the table? Does God belong in the bedroom? The traditional answer is God belongs everywhere, and that God exists where we let God in. And so, to me, the bigger issue here, regardless of whether it's do this or do that or not, is are we going to take the divine seriously in making these decisions?
All right. So I just want to take one step back from that because I agree with everything you said. And I just want to take a step back from, it doesn't even have to necessarily be for us the language of the divine, right? So some people at this table may not relate to that. What the divine stands in for some folks who might not have a theo.
Have it something higher.
Is a call to, yes, a system of values and ethics, an ultimate need to be what we would call good people. And Hartman actually raises that question, like, what does it mean for us to be good people in any certain context? And I think that's fair. Like, we can say maybe that we're using text from our tradition, which uses the divine as kind of the definer of that. Or like the ultimate of that. We don't even have to use God. What does it mean to be a good person and consume other living beings? What does it mean to be a good person and drive a car that depends on fossil fuels when we know what fossil fuel mining does, or it's not mining, whatever it's called, what that does, right? So that's the set of questions that we are engaged with, if we are engaged in a thoughtful conversation about the foundations of thoughtful Judaism, which is what this course is called.
For me, and for a couple of people I know, I know some people who say a prayer for the animal before every time it is slaughtered, and when they never take it for granted.
So if we do practices that keep us in touch with what that we actually are taking a life and what that means. I think of, I lived in northern Minnesota for 14 years, where the biggest minority, of course, were Indians. They don't like to be called Native Americans. They wanted to be called Indian, by the way. And so they said, you know, like their tradition was to consume and in the consuming to offer a prayer for the proliferation, right? Of the
animal,
of the species. And they used every part of the animal because that was how they could best honor the fact that a life had been taken.
Yep.
And so, like, I'm not questioning how each of our cultures want to do that, but I think one of the things that happens in this story is that Judah HaNasi gets like smacked in the head by being callous about the fact that you're taking a life.
Yeah. So it's up to each individual to determine how not to be callous. Because you're right, different cultures, different people have different ideas of what it is to be a good person. And I love the idea of using every part of an animal to honor the fact that a life was taken. I don't, for a variety of reasons. But I could give a little more thought to the meat that I'm eating. And maybe I will as an outcome to this course, but it is so subjective. So is the fact that we're just doing anything at all good enough, or are there rules in place?
So Stephen, 20 minutes ago, asked the same question, because that's ultimately where we keep coming back to, is where's the line? Who decides? Is it a communal decision? Is it a Jewish decision? Well, what the heck would that mean? The Jewish community decide? So let's talk for a second about, okay, so if we consume living things, if we consume resources, what are some of our understandings as liberal Jews at KI, forget everybody else, what are some of the criteria we might use or that we do use to decide that in your personal lives even?
In the question, where do you look for guidance in those criteria?
Well, we're working with that. We're working with some sources. We're working with some sources. But like, what? So tell me, where do y'all as Jews, as liberal Jews, because you're not going to go to halacha, you're not going to go to Jewish law as the definer. You were looking at some of it, the conversations that halacha's decided on in order to guide us. But like, so where, how do we make those decisions?
The westward expansion looked. There's this famous photo of this pile of buffalo skulls and this guy standing on top of it, and he's just like a little speck. And all these buffalo, they just let them bleach in the sun because they didn't want the natives to
have it.
They wanted to take the land. So it was a whole concentrated effort of control.
So where would you say, for you, that means the ethical, moral line of killing those buffalo is?
Waste.
Waste.
And control.
Okay. So you're only doing it to dominate somebody else. You don't care about what's actually going to happen to the animal that you kill. And in fact, you're wasting so much of the animal that's killed. Okay. So waste and the motivation of only to take control. It's not because you need the buffalo.
Right.
Right. To survive.
You want the
list. Would that change it if they needed the buffalo and then left them out to bleach?
I mean, the scale of it is the part of the problem.
Okay, so now you're adding another layer, which is the massive scale, which I think goes, Stephen, to your conversation about drilling for oil.
That's judgment, almost another era, another time. Yeah. So I don't know if you can go into the way back.
Or you can.
Termination.
You can also view it as a lesson. You can't really change what happened.
So should we not go back to the Holocaust and say, you know, maybe that wasn't such a good idea? They were living in their own time.
Oh, but you also look at...
No, I'm not being cheeky. I mean, I am being cheeky, but like, but seriously, can you really go back and say, we took all these animals from them so that they couldn't have them. We wasted every bit of that animal life and flesh and let it bleach under the sun just so that they couldn't have it. Can we not look at that and say that according to our tradition would be absolutely not okay in whatever time you're living in?
You can use that to apply them to how you feel today and the decisions that you make today. But I don't think you could really pass judgment on going back to
really? We can't pass judgment on people who wrapped Native Americans, Indians in blankets covered with smallpox because they wanted to expand their territory? We can't do that?
You can condemn it as wrong, but they're not, you're not living in their skin at that moment. So I don't know how you can just blank.
So then why do we study Cain and Hevel? Oh, well, we weren't at the beginning of creation where there'd never been a murder. And so it's okay that Cain kills Hevel. Then why do we study that text? Why bother? If it's like, oh, well, you know, Cain didn't know what murder was.
You're right.
And to do and better. And try to feel.
To learn to see mistakes.
Because we shouldn't do that
right.
Is the ultimate result. David? Don't do that.
No, just saying it's easier.
Yeah, something like that. What's harder is to look at what's happening right now, what you're doing right now. So it's, you know, I don't know. I'm sort of depending.
Well, I'm with Mary that what she's talking about is exactly what we're doing right now. It's the human saying, I get it, I want it. I need it. I want power. I want control. And I'll do whatever it takes. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll waste whatever it takes to drive my SUV. I'll waste whatever it takes.
Rooted in thinking you're better.
And thinking you deserve it. It's about power. It's about control. Right? It's not any different. Like, Stephen, I get it. And David, I get it that you're talking about, oh, well, we can't, like, who cares about the power? It's the same human motivation. It doesn't change since Torah times. David, you study Torah enough. You study Torah all the time. God bless you. You study Torah enough to know, has it really changed?
No, I'm not saying it's changed. I'm just saying that let's condemn ourselves in present rather than push it off on the past.
I think Mary's point is we always do this. We always do this as human beings. So let's just be honest about it. We always do this. And then there's hopefully pushback against doing that, right? And people say, wait, 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 this is not okay, right? And pushing back against it, right?
They brought the buffalo back. And some of the, there was a great documentary that went into it. Some of the people who helped only wanted to hunt, but they were part of the effort. That's how we got the national parks.
See, like, I love that. Mary's such a smartest person I've ever met. Not gonna lie. But this whole thing about the wolves, like they killed wolves and then they found out like the wolves affected, they're being gone, affected the entire ecosystem so that the whole ecosystem collapsed because the wolves weren't there. And it's like, so some of it is about, okay, we got to learn. We have to figure out, okay, we don't know what's right and wrong all the time. sometimes we know what we're doing is wrong. And sometimes we just have to learn, oh, wait, that wasn't a good idea. Like, so let's bring it back. And sometimes we did what was absolutely 100% knowingly wrong. And we still can come back from that and make the buffaloes happen. Margo?
I was going to say that to respond to the question, like, where do we draw the line? I think this is just kind of a personal experience, but like as my spiritual awakening started and consciousness began to expand, I think my food consciousness also kind of evolved along with that. And like,
and what does that mean?
So like, for example, like I developed like certain food allergies that actually kind of lined up with dietary laws of Judaism. Like as an adult, I couldn't eat shellfish anymore. You know, I couldn't all of a sudden, like I would like eat a cheeseburger and then like be violently ill afterwards. And like, these were things that I never had issues with before, but I think just again,
yeah, well, that might be guilt. That might be taking on Jewish guilt.
I mean, you know, like honestly, and I mean, you guys, I'm new, so there's all the journey is the journey. But like, I mean, it was like as the consciousness of like, oh, you know, maybe this is not something that I need, you know, to do. Like I'm having these like more negative reactions to like what used to be normal food choices that I made, but now I'm leaning towards, you know, more plant-based diet, you know, less animal products and other things, and seeing my body change, seeing, you know, health return, and just be, again, being more conscious about food and, you know, whether or not that it's powered by my ancestry and, you know, our tradition, I have found a lot of like personal, you know, spiritual benefit from being more conscious about food. And that's where I've drawn my personal line. I know that not everybody is on that journey, but.
And ultimately, yeah. That's the whole point. Like, right. Ultimately, that's the whole point of the whole thing. It's not where we come down. Ultimately, you're lifting up. The whole point of the whole set of discussions through 3,000 years is about being conscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's about being conscious, about being aware. Really, where the line comes is where it's going to have to constantly be a discussion and a conversation and a set of legislations, right? Like, because the line moves. The line moves. And so, but really the ultimate that Margo's pointing out is like, are we conscious when we eat? Are we conscious when we consume? Are we conscious? My lease is coming up for my car. I'm in a hybrid. Do I go electric? Like that's the right thing to do, right? Like,
too.
Yeah. And there's other implications to doing that. And like, what if someone hits the grid? We're all screwed. Like, so do I really go to all electric? Like, so, but the line's going to keep moving. Okay.
So I kind of see it as connected to the other ethics things that we have been reading.
Oh, thank God.
That the tension is in this one, it's sort of how much do we take care of humans versus how much do we take care of nature? Just like, who do we save first? Do we save our family first or do we save mankind first? Right. That it's a constant tension.
Beautiful. Beautifully stated. Covenant ethics. And creation ethics as represented by our relationship to the natural world and that tension. So beautifully stated.
It's all part of one whole. So
yes.
There's time to give it, take it away.
Right. And that's what makes it so complicated, right? And Judaism has always honored that it's complicated. We're not a black and white tradition, right? That we know it's complicated. We've studied both creation ethics and covenant ethics, and that appears here too. And that both of those were complicated. The tension between them is complicated. And so is it with the environment. So I'm happy I can leave y'all with a sense of that. It's just all very complicated. Stephen.
So I don't want you to drop the question that you put out, which was where the lines are drawn. And you mentioned waste. I'm curious where other people think the lines are affecting others or what are the.
So about your relationship to consumption vis-a-vis the natural world. Okay.
Question is, where do we go from here? Because in the end, so we're going to make our own decisions in the end, right? As people with free will. And the issue for me is, where do I go to find guidance? Mm-hmm. Where do I go to find the discussion of people who spent a lot of time thinking about these things, many of whom are smarter than me? We live such a short period of time on Earth. We have so little time to think about these things between work and family and whatever. And so for me, and you know, one can choose a fountain of knowledge anywhere they choose. For me, as you pointed out, the Jewish tradition is where I start. It's not necessarily where I end up. So my first question is always, like, what does Judaism have to say about this? And if I lived another 300 years, I might start to understand that. But so for me, I can't just make a decision without criteria. And a lot of people, you know, when we look at a lot of these issues and I see the discussion, I say, well, gee, I never thought about it that way. I never thought about it this way. So for me, that's a place where I would start. And I would start.
So you would start, what you're saying is where do I even begin to start making those decisions? And what you're saying is you start at rki.org.
Yeah, that. Me personally, and again, everybody decides where they're going to start or not. The worst thing is just to sit there and try and figure it out yourself without reference to anything else or anybody, and just looking at the time or what your friend said or anything like that. But I look to wisdom, and people find wisdom in many different places, and certainly Judaism isn't the only wisdom that exists.
And Jewish tradition would say, to your point, that's hubris. The ultimate hubris, idolatry, is saying, I know best, and that's what I'm going to decide. Okay, so
now I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
So when the congregation looks for that sort of guidance and judgment and comes to these four walls, but when it's a subject like Gaza, and there are many sides to that. So how are we supposed to sort of take that knowledge? What we learn here?
So if we're going to try to take these texts into a conversation about Gaza, for me, they don't relate directly, but I don't want to dodge your point about, right. So if we go to Jewish tradition, so I look to places that I trust, like Hartman. I just listened to a discussion between Yossi Klein Halevi and Doniel Hartman today, to your point about what does victory mean? Because remember, the whole conversation about Gaza has been, when victory has been achieved, we will retreat. So now the ethical, moral conversation is about what is victory, given the human suffering in Gaza, like what, and the risk to Israeli security. So I turn to sources that I trust, who draw on our sources to help me think about it. And that's in lots of different places. But to Bert's point, I feel like I have to look to the folks who draw from our tradition in a way that they have a way deeper access to the well than I have. Right. Like my bucket stops here, you know, and theirs goes all the way down. And my obligation, as I understand it, is to dig as deeply as I can so that I can bring that forward and bring it to us as a conversation. I don't see myself as an authority on it. I see myself as an authority on the approach of the text and the core values that we can then have a conversation about what the implications for us are and what our decisions need to be for each of us. Like, you know, Gaza is not one that we will have any control over, right? That will be for the Israelis to decide. But how we think and feel about it, I feel like, has to be, like Bert said, rooted in like, okay, so what are the values that are foremost for us right now in making our personal decisions about what we think should happen? And we have to be super informed in order to even have an opinion. And some things I feel like I don't need to have an opinion on. It's just like out of my realm of being able to really have an opinion on. Like other things I feel very clearly, like, you know, abortion is one of them for me right now. It's a values conversation for me. I worked in abortion care for 4 years before I went to rabbinical school. I feel like I have a lot to say, right, about the Jewish values around that conversation. I feel like I have a lot less, right, command of what would be needed to make good decisions in other areas that are just way beyond my ken. But thank you for the question, I think. Lori?
I think what's interesting to me is this kind of relates back to last week also, which is we know that there's this much we can do. Is it okay to do this much? Remember, we were talking about, do you help your family or do you help everybody? Do you give away all your money or do you only give away some of your money? So it seems to me that we, each of us, if we are conscious and if we're trying to make ethical decisions, we still have to decide how far should I go and how far, like, what is more than I'm capable of doing? And I think that that's what I think about all the time. So, like, with eating, for instance, I used to keep kosher, and then I stopped, and I did because I thought kosher meat was more ethical in terms of being slaughtered humanely. Then when I realized maybe they're slaughtering them humanely, but they're raising them inhumanely, I've switched over to only buying meat where I feel comfortable with how the meat's been raised. But I'm not willing to go farther than that and give up meat altogether. So I just think it's really interesting to be thinking about, we can start from the beginning values of protecting the earth or being compassionate. And then what's the right answer is, how far are you able to go with that? It's just, it's complicated.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
And I think that if we have Jewish law, because I started from kashrut, that if you just say, well, I keep kosher and that's all I have to do and I don't have to think about it again. And I think that by not being halachic, I don't know what people in halachic communities do, but whether they say, this is the baseline and I have to continue to do better, or as long as I follow these rules, I'm okay.
So in halachic communities, it's the latter. As long as I follow these rules, I'm okay. And that, for people who want to, like, I'm tired, so I'm not going to use the right language. I don't mean make fun, but for people who want to dismiss that as not having to think, guess what? Mm-hmm. It is way better to feel like you are always doing what's right because someone has told you, here are mm-hmm. the parameters and you don't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
I got that. We got this. Like, you know, and God has sanctioned it. Wow. That is, and I'm not being sarcastic when I say, what a relief to live that way, right? If you can't, it's a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. If it's on us to decide, that's a lot more complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Where am I ready to recycle? Where am I not? Where am I ready to eat, you know, in line with my ethics and values that I ultimately would want to? Where am I not yet ready? Am I hoping, like Jonathan Sachs always said, you know, do you keep kosher? And his answer could be to them, not yet, mm-hmm. right? Like, no is not just the answer. It's a not yet. Like, there's a not yet to so much of us being ready to hold both, like you said so beautifully, the reality of what we're willing to do and our ideals, which may be over here. And so it's kind of the being willing to say not yet, right? Not yet am I ready to give up my commitment to fossil fuels. Because what if, and my anxiety kicks in, what if I have to go far and I don't have enough of a charge and then there's not a charging station? You're like, so my anxiety may preclude me from living into my value of not using fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. If we can hold a not yet, I feel like that, to your point, Lori, of what are we willing to do? What can we do? Like, not yet is a great way
mm-hmm.
to hold without judgment that I have an ideal that I'm not yet living into. I don't have to be a hypocrite. I don't have to be less. I can say.
That's what I love about
I'm working on it.
Is mm-hmm. that you have that flexibility or room for those feelings, for those actions. I love that idea of not yet.
Mm-hmm. Not yet.
But I think one thing also is, as Bert said, going to the Jewish tradition can inform us, can raise our consciousness, you know, that these rules are not just archaic things, but even though I don't have kosher food in my house and I still have separate dishes. And so that means every time I eat something that's meat, I say to myself, I'm eating meat, because I have to decide which dish to pull. So even though it's not kosher meat, so little practices like that, that were built into Judaism, again, people could do them by rote and it doesn't have an effect on them, but they're there to raise our consciousness, I think.
Helene?
To some extent.
Yeah, thanks, I just I pretty much agree with what everyone has said, and I think that, you know, we are stewards of the land, and I think in the 21st century, I think everyone should become more conscious of how we do that. And we live, we're a part of an ecosystem too. So we're all part of it. We're not just separate. We're just not sentient beings who can do whatever they want to do whenever they want to do it. And as time evolves, you know, initially the Industrial Revolution made a great change in a positive way, but now we see some of the effects that aren't so great, some of the things that aren't so great.
As Micha Goodman would say, the unintended consequences of the Industrial Revolution, which includes polarization as being like the unintended consequence of that. But go ahead.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. So I think as we see what's happening with the earth, I think the more we can educate ourselves and join organizations that support mitigating the effects of climate change, and coming from a Jewish tradition and a Jewish perspective, I think it behooves all of us to start paying more attention. So rather than, you know, if we want to eat meat, rather than eating meat from a large farm factory where the cows are just shoved in and there's no grassland, perhaps we can think about eating regenerative meat from regenerative farms. You know, there are little steps we can take, as people have said. And, you know, we may want to get over there eventually, but if we take just incremental steps, you know, little by little, it can have a huge impact on where we're going as a species. It's really
dependent
upon us.
From your mouth, Helene. Faye.
So one problem that I have with this is that it doesn't talk about rationalization versus education.
Well, can you say more about that?
So, for example, as I learned more about the connection of food and the environment, that influenced my behavior, even though it wasn't comfortable. So I don't see that in me.
What part do you think is missing in terms of once you learned that your consumption caused certain damage, Yehuda HaNasi learns that it's not right to not have compassion, and then changes and has compassion on the weasel.
Okay. That, I think, is not, it's not a sacrifice or a limitation, really, in a meaningful way.
Okay.
That part I have an issue.
Where's the guilt? Because without the guilt, it's not efficacious? So I guess what I hear you saying is, you don't see a real struggle in these texts for what it means to take in what one learns about the impact on the environment and then have to make decisions that are seriously uncomfortable, like driving in an all-electric car. So those texts, that's not here, but I think we could pull texts. If we said to Hartman, please pull texts that are more about the agony of having to give stuff up, you know, once one learns, blah, blah, my bet is it's there. And that was not the goal of this set of texts, but I appreciate you saying, I mean, I think about Yom Kippur, like, you know, like all of the texts about it should hurt on Yom Kippur. Once you know this can affect tshuva and your willingness to do tshuva, then you sacrifice eating and drinking and making love and being anointed and like all, you sacrifice all of that once you learn or take seriously that this could mean you could affect tshuva. So it's not that it's not there, but it's true. It's not part of this conversation about environmentalism, and our relationship to the environment, which I totally appreciate. Susan?
Yes, I'd like to follow on what Helene had to say.
I just wanted to point out that right in our own community, there's an organization, Resilient Palisades, that is working towards affecting the environment. I've learned a lot about food through that organization, learned a lot about fossil fuels, about solar energy and our use of plastics. And this Sunday, we're celebrating Earth Day in the Village Green in the Palisades. So everyone is welcome to come and learn from 9 to 1 o'clock.
Beautiful. A great place to end. We're not going to get, I don't think it's like, gonna take us very far to deeper into this to look at sources 4 and 5. But I want to tell you that source 4 is about, even in a time of war, one is not allowed to destroy fruit trees. And this becomes the basis for much of Jewish conversation and approach morally and ethically to the idea of wanton destruction. So Bal Tashchit, you'll see it if you go to places that are Jewishly very observant. You'll see a sign over the toilet that says Bal Tashchit, right? So, like, you shouldn't waste paper, right? Just be sparing and like what you're going to use, right? So there's lots of places over water, certain places where water in Israel is present, Bal Tashchit. You shall not wantonly destruct in the case of fruit trees, because people should eat from them, and the fruit trees can't withdraw in a time of war, so they shouldn't be wantonly destroyed. But it became the basis for a lot of Jewish understanding about the ethics and morals of wanton destruction. And I think for me, as we've had this conversation, for me, there's a lot of resonance about wanton destruction, like destruction that is just not necessary.
When this conversation's been going on now for an hour or something, and the point we're making that being talked about is how we are paying attention to other humans and so forth. I kept thinking about, well, what about the elephants and what about the giraffes and what about the, and perhaps they, one level that maybe we can't quite figure out, but they may have something to say about, well, what about us? And what are you doing to our communities? So it's got to go way wider than what we're talking about.
Right. So that we have to think about all living creatures on the planet and our relationship to them and our responsibility for them, which brings us right back, thank you, Linda Scheibel, to Genesis, which is, we live in relationship to lots of other living creatures because we are the dominant species. We're at the top of the food chain, literally. We impact, and as I started with it, the planet will be fine, but other creatures on this planet won't be if we continue with wanton destruction and we continue with our own disregard for at least a set of understandings about how we can start to have serious conversations about what our moral and ethical responsibility is to life on this planet and to creation. That is our sacred work, is to start figuring that out together. And thank you, Susan, for bringing it to the tachlis, to bring it to the concrete, that we can show up in the park this weekend, in the Palisades from 9 to 1, and figure out, okay, is there one more step I can take? One more thing I can do? Because we're all at not yet. And if we can live in a place of non-judgy not yetness, then what we do is encourage our own growth and our own commitment and the expansion of that commitment. Faye, as you said, once you learned X, Y, and Z, you then made some decisions about, and Lori, you said the same thing, that once you learn certain things, it's like, okay, now I'm ready to go to what was not yet my practice before I learned this. And it was really distressing, in terms of the proper holy upsetness, right, about what we're doing and what we're inflicting on the rest of creation. So
and it's a very optimistic approach. Like, it helps you not sit in the
Because if we stay in guilt and judgment and whatever, it doesn't really tend to move us very far. Like it's not terribly helpful in my experience. And so we are now concluding our Hartman series for the spring. I want to thank you for coming back again and again to have these really thoughtful and meaningful conversations that we hope are just the seed of what will grow in your world, in your life, in your mind, in your decisions, in your approach, in your conversations with other people, that this is just a seed. This is not supposed to be the answer. This is not, okay, now I got it, right? This is about starting a conversation because that was our commitment to Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism, is to be thoughtful about using, as Bert said so beautifully, our own tradition, our own texts, our own outlines of how to begin talking about where our ethical and moral responsibilities are. It's an ongoing conversation, and I hope that we take that conversation seriously. So I hope that you will join us for the next series of Hartman lectures, which will begin at some point.